I next met with Dr. Maury Gertz to toss out some of the questions and cases we got from the audience about myeloma, beginning with a very challenging case. 82-year-old woman with IgA myeloma and mental changes. I am convinced that it's hyperviscosity syndrome. All other organic reasons and scans and MRIs are negative. I transfer her to a tertiary center for plasmapheresis, but it's not done because the serum viscosity comes back at 1.8, and the physician didn't want to continue that. Mental issues persist. Who's right?
Well, you know, an 82-year-old who ends up in the hospital has about a dozen different potential causes for mental confusion. Hyperviscosity is best known in Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia because the pentamers, which weigh, you know, a million Daltons, can really cause syrupy serum. I've seen hyperviscosity in IgA multiple myeloma in relapse with levels of 6,000 and 7,000 IgA. And that's probably because IgA forms dimers, and dimers will cause viscosity, which you wouldn't get with IgG at a level of 11,000 because they're all monomers. Remembering that the normal viscosity of serum is 1.7, because water is 1.0, 1.8 isn't high. In my practice, I don't even check the viscosity unless the IgA is over 5,000. I don't even bother checking it. In this situation, if the viscosity lab is reliable, then it's not a hard test to do. I would tend to think that there would have to be other mental changes. It's not impossible for patients to have myeloma meningitis. I've seen that cause, usually late in the disease, cause mental changes. But did she receive steroids to treat her myeloma? Was there infection? Was she borderline demented and then she's taken away from her home environment in the hospital and gets confused? I think all of those are possible. Sleeping pills, the usual culprits in the hospitalized elderly.
Myelomatous meningitis, how often do you see it and what do you do about it?
Well, most reliable literature suggests that the median survival after diagnosis is about 6 weeks. It's treated the way leukemic meningitis is, methotrexate, cytarabine intrathecally. It's relatively ineffective and it's usually a reflection of terminal disease. A lot of them present with focal findings. I mean, they'll present with a third nerve palsy or facial droop because they get deposits at the base of the brain. The neurologist will do the lumbar puncture. Malignant cells will be seen. Whether it's the cause in someone who just has a diffuse change in their mentation without focal findings, well, I've seen that as well. They get complicated. But, you know, you have a confused patient. You ask, should a lumbar puncture be done?
Here's another question. What's the optimal duration of bisphosphonate therapy in a responding myeloma patient? And another question was, can we stop zoledronic acid after transplant if the patient's in remission?
The question about the optimal duration of bisphosphonate use underwent a radical change just in the last 1 month. A publication from the MRC that was published in Lancet Oncology from the MRC group reported on a thalidomide-based induction regime followed by stem cell transplant. What no one expected was that there was a 6-month survival superiority for the zoledronic acid arm. The other arm was an oral bisphosphonate that's not available in the United States.
That's cladrenate?
Cladrenate. So when you think about the fact that there were 1,000 patients in each arm, a 6-month survival advantage is 500 patient years. So it's really quite a remarkable finding. It wasn't part of a planned sub-analysis, but that arm had an absolutely superior survival. In the design of the study, the plan was to treat to progression or 2 years. The median actual time administered of zoledronic acid was 1 year. The survival advantage looks to occur all in the first 4 months. Then the lines become parallel again. So if you had asked the question 6 months ago, we would have talked about NCCN guidelines and ASCO guidelines, which recommend a year of bisphosphonate or 2 years of bisphosphonate in patients who are responsive and achieve a plateau. But now with the question of a survival advantage in zoledronic acid, you can be certain that all of those cooperative groups are now going back to the drawing board to redraw their bisphosphonate recommendations. And there is in vitro data, there is published in vitro data about an anti-tumor effect of zoledronic acid and the possibility of a synergistic anti-tumor effect in vitro between zoledronic acid and thalidomide, zoledronic acid and bortezomib both. So there may be a basic science basis to explain the findings. But for right now, even though the published guidelines would suggest 1 to 2 years, this very, very recent data would suggest treatment until progression.
But to me, these data suggested that somehow bisphosphonates could have an impact on survival, but I don't see that it has that much to do with duration.
That's a valid point. You can only go by the way the study was designed. The study was designed for treatment to progression, but the median administered was 1 year. If you look at the survival curves, all of the survival advantage appears to occur in the first 4 months. So you could argue, if you wanted to interpret the data, that the benefit from the bisphosphonates all occurred very, very early. But that's not the way the study was designed. The study was designed to go to progression.
So have there been patients that you've actually changed what you've done because of this?
Our group is actually, there's Mayo consensus guidelines as well, and our group is rapidly reassessing our stance because our stance actually had been to use pomidronate because A, it was less expensive, and B, because it had a lower incidence of osteonecrosis of the jaw. But there's an in-press article looking at late follow-up of a randomized study of pomidronate, and there's no survival advantage for the non-pomidronate arm. So it doesn't duplicate what was published with zoledronic acid. So we're beginning to rework our recommendations to incorporate the recent zoledronic acid data. And because of the survival advantage, it tends to minimize the concerns about osteonecrosis of the jaw, which can be reduced with good dental hygiene, antibiotic prophylaxis before dental extractions and the like.
So what did your guidelines from Mayo say before about duration, and what are they going to say now?
Well, what they used to say was that you would treat to 1 year, and in patients who achieved a VGPR or better, those patients would be discontinued. In patients who had not achieved the VGPR or better, we went to quarterly bisphosphonate administration. But I feel confident that those will change in order to incorporate these new findings.
And are they going to change to indefinite?
That would be unlikely. With patients having a median survival of 8 years, I find it unlikely that our group would endorse 8 years of monthly bisphosphonate because the risk of osteonecrosis is actuarial and it rises with every year on treatment, but I can't honestly tell you where we'll finally land on it.
What are you thinking yourself?
I'm thinking it would be hard to deny giving zoledronic acid monthly for 2 years and after that have a discussion with the patient about the risks of osteonecrosis and kidney dysfunction versus what has been published in one large study regarding a survival advantage in bisphosphonate-treated patients, zoledronic acid-treated patients.
So I was just writing a piece about breast cancer where I was referring to this MRC study, and you may know that a couple of years ago there was an Austrian trial showing a disease-free survival benefit in breast cancer with zoledronic acid, and then just in December at San Antonio, a huge trial was reported, and it wasn't there. So is this going to be confirmed by other studies?
Difficult to know. The MRC study had 1,000 patients in each arm, which for multiple myeloma is a very, very large trial. And because cladrenate isn't used very much, certainly it's not used at all in the United States, it's used minimally in France and in Italy, the likelihood that a study will look at two different bisphosphonates or different bisphosphonate schedules is pretty small, I'm afraid.
Here's another question. Would the conditioning for an older patient with no renal impairment be melphalan 200 or 140?
This is a question. If you're going to do a stem cell transplant in a patient, let's say between the age of 70 and 75 with normal renal function, should we be scaling back? Our own data suggests that age 70 to 75, does not require a dose reduction. It doesn't increase bacteremia or hospital days at the higher dose. The only thing that absolutely requires dose modification is a decline in the serum creatinine. If your creatinine is over 2, you need to give 140.
This is probably from the same person. What about conditioning or reduced intensity conditioning to avoid busulfan and cyclophosphamide?
Well, for an allogeneic transplant, I think very few people would use busulfan as conditioning in autologous transplant. An allogeneic transplant, I'd have to say that most of the regimens are low-dose TBI melphalan or fludarabine melphalan, and busulfan isn't used because of the risk of veno-occlusive disease. And so for a non-leukemia allo transplant or mini-allo, I think busulfan's not an ideal choice.
Okay, here's a case that was submitted. Healthy 60-year-old woman, new diagnosis of advanced multiple myeloma, starts on bortezomib dex for 6 cycles, but during the last cycle progresses dramatically with widespread soft tissue plasmacytomas. Refuses all treatments, but then agrees to, quote, palliative thalidomide, only 50 milligrams a day, and then achieves a VGPR stable for 5 months. Now has a tiny increase in her monoclonal band. Any suggestions?
So you have someone who's relatively young, who had novel agent induction and a very, very short response. 6 cycles is 18 weeks of therapy. Too bad prognostic. Now, the kinetics of relapse are discouraging, and the fact that there was extramedullary disease with plasmacytomas. Others have actually argued that extramedullary disease is relatively insensitive to thalidomide, so seeing a VGPR is very encouraging. I suspect if you check, this patient is likely to have adverse cytogenetics. If the patient is not developing any neurotoxicity, I certainly would be very disinclined to withdraw the thalidomide. I'd also have a discussion with the patient about whether she would consider having her stem cells collected so that they could be used if that M protein continues to rise. She's only 60. The morbidity associated with stem cell transplant would be relatively modest. She's already refractory to bortezomib, so her options, if she breaks through thalidomide, are melphalan in high dose and stem cell transplant, melphalan in low dose, maybe with dex and lenalidomide. And of course, then you start getting into, would you consider bendamustine in such a patient, this sort of thing.
Yeah, I just recently heard about bendamustine in myeloma. What do we know about that?
Bendamustine was reported only in abstract form at the ASH meetings in 2010. But what they reported was very impressive because it was used in a refractory relapsing population, and they showed that there was a significant response rate in patients who'd failed other novel agents. So although bendamustine, of course, is labeled only for chronic lymphatic leukemia, the consideration of off-label, because it would be off-label, it's not approved for any phase of multiple myeloma, would be, I think, reasonable. We currently have a protocol at Mayo that's bendamustine, lenalidomide, dexamethasone for relapsed disease. We think it's a very intriguing agent that will likely add to the armamentarium somewhere.
Have you had any patients who you think benefited from it without getting anything else? I mean, you got lenalidomide dex on board, it'd be kind of hard to figure it out.
We've definitely used bendamustine sporadically in patients who really have failed all standard therapies, all the 4 classes of standard therapies, alkylators, steroids, IMIDs, and proteasome inhibitors, and weren't eligible. Bad blood counts, high creatinine, too many prior regimens for any of our investigational trials, we've used off-label bendamustine, significant dose reduction, not 90 milligrams per meter squared for 2 days, but maybe 1 day or 60 for 2 days, and have seen very real responses.
All right. The next question is a response to one of the cases we discussed. If you remember, there was a 75-year-old man who was in great condition, and the transplanters didn't want to consider transplant because he had symptomatic bronchiectasis. And he had a couple episodes that the doc had to treat, you know, during the time he was being managed. But otherwise, he was in great health. So this doc says, does it really make sense to preclude transplant for myeloma based on a pulmonary diagnosis? antibacterials could be used. Why not use pulmonary function tests?
Not a straightforward answer. Clearly, it's the frequency of the infections. Does he have purulent sputum? We have to keep in mind that with the transplant, the patient will be neutropenic for a period of about 8 or 9 days, from about day 4 till about day 12. And during that time, if there's active purulent sputum, is that going to cause pneumonitis, which would be the number one cause of mortality in stem cell transplant, would be pulmonary infection. And so I must admit, I'd be pretty nervous because at age 75, there's still a lot of non-high-dose options available to this patient. I think there's very real risk, and I respect them for being circumspect about just jumping in with both feet.
Yeah, I guess also it depends why you're doing a transplant in this situation, and it's not really an issue of cure.
It is not a cure. It would be, I assure you, a very different answer if this was large cell lymphoma.
All right, another case. 53-year-old woman presented with an anterior upper chest pain, found to have a T4 vertebral mass, referred pain to the chest, biopsy of the vertebral mass, so sheets of plasma cells. Workup shows minimal bone marrow involvement, diffuse small plasmacytomas of the entire spine, lytic lesion, ribs, pelvis. Treated with bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone with rapid progression, rise in serum light chains, treated with DTV PACE, controlled, then stem cell transplant, now NED. What a story. Since the patient progressed rapidly on prior lenalidomide, would you still give post-SCT maintenance? That's a straightforward one,
yeah,
right?
Well, it's very challenging because this patient clearly broke through on lenalidomide, and it was really high-dose melphalan that produced the complete response. A patient who has actual tumor growth while receiving bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone, to me, doesn't sound like a logical candidate for lenalidomide maintenance. I think this patient has already demonstrated inherent resistance to that regimen.
As long as we sort of brought it up, you know, the meeting that we did was the night before ASH, so we didn't have what happened at ASH. And hearing that this patient got bortezomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone, even though the patient didn't do well, reminds me to ask you, what did you think about the presentation by Jakubiak at ASH looking at substituting carfilzomib for the bortezomib and the RVD regimen, so to speak?
Right. So it was impressive. He's a respected investigator from the University of Michigan. Clearly, putting carfilzomib, there was no insinuation that it is superior in any way. And of course, the scheduling is complex, 2 days, 2 weeks. Nonetheless, it's not a neurotoxic agent. And that is a big deal. You know, one of the concerns about the use of bortezomib, which is so highly effective, is that you have patients who now have a median survival of 8 years. Do you want them to spend those 8 years with neuropathy? Now, in the meetings, we talk about grade 3-4 neuropathy, but grade 3 neuropathy is pretty severe neuropathy. It means interferes with the activities of daily living. Grade 2, we don't talk about as much, but grade 2 is interferes with function, but doesn't interfere with activities of daily living. And even people with grade 1 neuropathy that can be painful still require gabapentin to fall asleep, sometimes codeine to fall asleep. It's not a good way to spend 8 years. There's a couple ways this is being looked at. One would be using an alternate proteasome inhibitor that's not neurotoxic. And carfilzomib does not appear to have any neurotoxicity, yet high activity and no sacrifice in response rate. But there's two other things. Palumbo's written the use of weekly bortezomib, and weekly bortezomib sharply reduces the neurotoxicity. And in fact, in my own practice, I've really moved away from twice-weekly bortezomib for once-weekly bortezomib. And in fact, most of the studies show total cumulative bortezomib dose you administer is higher with the weekly because you continue it longer and you don't have as many dose mods. And so that's one way to deal with neurotoxicity. Moreau reported a remarkable abstract on subcutaneous bortezomib. He took the same bortezomib, diluted it in half as much saline, and gave the same dose injected. He did pharmacokinetic studies that showed a much lower peak with the subcutaneous, but the same area under the curve, and significantly lower neurotoxicity, suggesting that maybe the neurotoxicity is the peak rather than the dose. As a consequence, that has exciting potential. A, maybe patients will start taking it home and self-administering it and avoiding a trip into the office. Two, getting all of the benefits associated with bortezomib without the neurotoxicity. And I must admit, when I heard the abstract, I thought to myself, parenthetically, could we reduce the peak dose simply by slowing the infusion? In other words, we give bortezomib in 5 minutes, and we know what the peak is. You kind of wonder if you infused it over 60 minutes, if you would reduce the peak and reduce the neurotoxicity. And of course, that wouldn't require going through an entire relabeling process, which you would need to do if you were going to give the same agent subcutaneously.
Any comments on the overall major important trends in myeloma management?
I think what we're seeing is a movement from two-drug induction to three-drug induction. So 5 years ago, we were talking about Thal-Dex, Lenalidomide-Dex, Bortezomib-Dex. Now, we had Michele Cavo, who presented a randomized study of Bortezomib-Thalidomide-Dex followed by tandem transplant in younger patients compared to Thalidomide-Dex and tandem transplant, showed a significantly higher response rate, higher complete response rate, and a higher relapse-free survival than patients who received the two-drug regimen. For older patients, Palumbo presented bortezomib, melphalan, prednisone, thalidomide with bortezomib, thalidomide maintenance versus, quote, the standard for elderly patients, melphalan, prednisone, bortezomib, the so-called VMP regimen, and found a significant advantage, again, not overall survival because it's not that mature, but with complete response rates and 3-year overall survival being 89% was shocking, suggesting that there's some movement to move from two-drug regimens, in other words, a steroid and a novel agent, an alkylator and a novel agent, to three-drug regimens, which are a proteasome inhibitor in IMID and a steroid or a proteasome inhibitor in IMID and melphalan. And so I think that's the trend that I'm seeing in the community that will come.
How about your own trend? Do you see that? I mean, it's happened with a lot of people in the pre-transplant setting with things like RVD, but I haven't heard that much about like triple therapy in the non-transplant setting. Are people doing it? Are you doing it?
I'm not. I'm still using melphalan, prednisone, thalidomide, melphalan, prednisone, bortezomib, melphalan, prednisone, and modified dose lenalidomide. But that's still a very intriguing study. It was just presented a month ago, so I haven't changed my practice quite yet. Nonetheless, it still is a very intriguing concept. And I should just mention the nature of the maintenance, because it contains bortezomib, the bortezomib was once every 2 weeks, and the neurotoxicity was very low with that schedule.
Here's another question. What does IgM myeloma progress to, and what is the differential diagnosis when you find this in connective tissue disorders?
IgM multiple myeloma constitutes approximately 3% of all multiple myeloma. But the clinical picture is not different. It's still anemia, lytic bone lesions, and renal insufficiency. When you look at the bone marrow, quite frankly, they mark strongly with CD38 and CD138. They're CD20 negative. This is not a lymphoplasmacytic disorder. This is myeloma that happens to make an IgM monoclonal protein. I think the problem for the community oncologist is when they see an IgM protein, not to assume it's guaranteed to be Waldenstrom's. You still have to do the bone marrow and you have to look at the morphology. The morphology is still pretty good. The morphology in IgM myeloma is plasma cell. And of course, in IgM Waldenstrom's, it's lymphoplasmacytic strongly expressing CD20. Clinical course isn't different. We've treated them identically.
Another question, best regimen to treat IgD myeloma?
If you look at IgD myeloma from a clinical standpoint, it really, really looks just like light chain myeloma. Typically, the IgDs are very small and a very high proportion have heavy light chain proteinuria and a high level of the serum-free light chain. I treat them the same way as I do other late-chain myelomas. All I would say is that because there's a high proportion of patients who have light chains in the urine, there's a high proportion of patients who develop cast nephropathy. And when I say cast nephropathy, I automatically include bortezomib as part of that regimen because of its rapidity of action and the fact that it doesn't require adjustment if there's an element of renal insufficiency.
Couple other questions about maintenance treatment. In the post-transplant setting, in what situation should we use bortezomib maintenance? Another question, are there situations where double agent maintenance, parentheses, bortezomib and lenalidomide, for example, should be used after transplant?
So in prospective randomized study, the only data is on lenalidomide, but two large studies, one from the Chemotherapy Trials Network and one from the IFM, both of which showed a significant advantage in relapse-free survival, not overall survival yet, just relapse-free survival. No phase 3 studies looking at bortezomib, but as I just alluded to earlier, there is Palumbo's study where he's using maintenance bortezomib and thalidomide in over the age 65 myeloma patients and is showing that maintenance improves relapse-free survival, also hasn't shown an overall survival benefit. And in that, the bortezomib is once every 2 weeks. Bortezomib with lenalidomide as maintenance hasn't been published in abstract form, so I couldn't even tell you what the correct dosing would be, because now you're talking about two agents capable of producing myelosuppression and thrombocytopenia.
So maybe sort of related, another question. In community practice, when should we use FISH to stratify patients? Does it affect maintenance or induction as doing triple induction? Any thoughts about where we are right now with cytogenetics and the age of novel treatment?
Right. And recognizing that reimbursement policies vary from place to place, we know that patients that, first let's talk about what the high risks are. It's 4, 14, 14, 16, minus 17P, and gains in 1Q. Those are the big bad prognostic factors. Why bother? Well, because the largest study done comparing melphalan prednisone with bortezomib melphalan prednisone suggested that those bad prognostic features were not significant in a bortezomib-treated population, suggesting that bortezomib neutralizes the adverse effect of 414 and 1416. And in a relapsed population, Donna Reese has published in her group that bortezomib neutralizes those but doesn't have an impact on the 1Q gains. And so we have used that to direct therapy. In addition, those bad chromosomal abnormalities predict for very short duration following autologous stem cell transplant. Median's only 8 months. And so it really raises a question, if that's the true median, do you really want to get involved in stem cell transplant with patients that have this bad prognostic factor for fear that as soon as they recover from the effects of the transplant, they'll start to show progression again. So we use it because patients who are low risk, who don't have any genetic or kinetic abnormalities, standard therapy, low toxicity induction is what we're looking for, and high dose therapy will provide benefit. Intermediate with bad 414, 1416, those patients always have a bortezomib in line for their treatment. Patients who have a minus 17P, which is really the worst, or have very high labeling index or Ki antigen expression, those are the patients we start thinking about allogeneic transplant. We use it sparingly in our practice, but we don't know what else to do for those very high-risk patients. And so we think when they're high-risk, it's okay to consider high-risk interventions such as non-myeloablative transplantation.
What about bortezomib maintenance, you know, maybe along with lenalidomide in those patients?
Hasn't been explored, but clearly, given what we know about those cytogenetic abnormalities, it would make logical sense. But there isn't a lot of literature data to actually support that evidence-based.
So a related question, should we repeat cytogenetics fish at relapse?
We do. Certainly, clonal evolution does occur in myeloma. You will find the original abnormalities, but you will find acquired abnormalities. Now, frankly, in the relapse setting, will finding new acquired genetic abnormalities impact on your treatment? Well, that's certainly not as well defined as it is in a newly diagnosed patient. So I don't think one could be critical if someone didn't do it, because your therapeutic options are so much more constrained that you may just be giving the same treatment without regard to those genetic findings.
So here's one you'd be interested in, and we saw a little more data on this at ASH. What situations should we use R big D now, if any?
Okay, so let's talk about R big D versus R little D, dexamethasone. Again, what do we know? We know that the response rate is higher in big D. And that was because cardiovascular mortality was lower with R little D, but the response rate was higher with big D. What were the restrictions in the study? If the creatinine was greater than 2.5, you weren't eligible. So if your creatinine's over 2.5, I don't know if there's a difference. Secondly, the early mortality seen is usually in the first 4 months. So the question is, if you go past 4 months, have you gone past that early mortality risk? And now all of a sudden, the higher response rate with big D would be justifiable. I think it would be a mistake to say that there's no role for intensive dexamethasone. There are patients who are profoundly cytopenic who can't tolerate any myelosuppressive therapy. There are patients who are beyond initial diagnosis, and that data simply wouldn't apply to patients who've already survived 6 months into disease. And finally, the data doesn't apply to anyone whose creatinine is over 2.5. So I think there are selective situations where you would ask yourself, might this not be appropriate for big D, but for newly diagnosed and creatinine less than 2.5, I never use high-dose dexamethasone in my practice.
Okay, here's another one. What thromboprophylaxis do we need to use with lenalidomide maintenance, if any? Since technically myeloma is in remission, could we avoid thromboprophylaxis just like we do in standard risk deletion 5q MDS?
I think we have to be careful. We certainly have seen in our own practice late clots, but one of the problems that comes up, we've had all kinds of issues with using subcutaneous low molecular weight heparin. We've had problems with reimbursement. We've had some insurers say, you have to come into the office to get the injection or we won't reimburse. Well, sometimes, and in some practices, that means a visit to the ER on Saturday, Sunday. I think that's ridiculous. I think warfarin is very difficult to administer prophylactically to these patients. Stable warfarin dosing requires that people be on a stable profile of medicines. But by virtue of the fact that we're giving weekly dexamethasone, they're not on a stable profile. In addition, in my practice certainly, I use prophylactic antibiotics the first few months of induction with multiple myeloma. And the antibiotics are just torture when you're trying to regulate the warfarin. So basically, I use aspirin. There is a DVT risk. It's about 6%. I would rather use aspirin and then anticoagulate 6% than anticoagulate 100% of patients in order to prevent that small fraction getting an active DVT.
Okay, finally, we got a couple questions on amyloidosis. How should we follow patients with amyloidosis for response or relapse? And since amyloidosis patients might be prone to neuropathy, should we avoid bortezomib?
Okay. First of all, the monitoring of patients with amyloid, there's two things you want to monitor, the hematologic and the organ. The hematologic response in amyloid is relatively easy to monitor using the free light chain assay. Looking at changes in the involved free light chain or subtracting the uninvolved from the involved and looking at that difference and following that serially is very useful. And I find it more useful than looking at the ratio, because the ratio of free light chain is too dependent on small changes in the uninvolved free light chain. So that. Organ monitoring. For the heart, I think the NT-proBNP is the best parameter to follow, recognizing two things. Number one, it can be a volatile test, and IMIDs, particularly lenalidomide, make the BNP go up without aggravating the cardiac failure. But it's far more reproducible than echocardiography. For patients with renal amyloidosis, the 24-hour urine total protein is really what you're trying to fix. You're trying to reduce their nephrotic range proteinuria so they don't go on to develop dialysis-dependent renal disease. For patients who do not have established neuropathy, I have no qualms about using bortezomib, although, as I mentioned earlier, I use it in a weekly basis because these patients clearly are predisposed. But I wouldn't let the fear of neuropathy keep me from using a potentially highly active agent in the management. For patients who have established neuropathy, it depends. If they have autonomic neuropathy, I'm inclined not to use the agent. And if they have a mild peripheral neuropathy, I'm inclined to use it, monitor closely. I would point out that bortezomib in the phase 1, phase 2 studies that were done by a consortium of Italy, Great Britain, and Canada excluded patients with New York Heart Class 3 and 4 heart failure. And because bortezomib has been sporadically reported to be cardiotoxic, you have to be a little careful giving it to the advanced cardiac amyloids because you just don't know what will happen. We still do a lot of stem cell transplants for amyloidosis.